Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of the APGRD podcast, Staging the Archive. I'm Claire Barnes, I'm one of the archivists, and I'm delighted to be joined by two guests, Edith Hall and Rosie Wiles. Edith is Professor of Classics at King's College London. She'll no doubt be familiar to you from her publications on classical cultures and receptions, including authoring a whopping 31 books, I've just discovered. Most recently, Aristotle's Way, also A People's History of Classics. That's part of her successful Classics in Class project with Henry Stead. She's also participated in numerous TV and radio appearances and has a delightfully named blog called The Edithorial. She also co-founded the APGRD in 1996, so it's lovely to have her here on the podcast. It's also a real pleasure to welcome Rosie. Rosie is lecturer in classical history and literature at the University of Kent. Her work has a particular focus on the staging and reception of Greek drama. She's contributed to several theatre projects and BBC documentaries. She's also the author of Costume in Greek Tragedy, that's published by Bristol Classical Press, and has an upcoming publication, Theatre Props and Civic Identity in Athens, published by Bloomsbury Academic. And the reason we brought Edith and Rosie together on this podcast today is to discuss their recent book. So we usually have an item from our archive as a point of focus for these episodes, but today it's an item from our library. The book is entitled Ancient Theatre and Performance Culture Around the Black Sea, that's published by Cambridge University Press, and it's co-edited by Edith and Rosie, as well as David Braund, Emeritus Professor at the University of Exeter. And it brings together this really quite impressive host of interdisciplinary contributors. I've been busily scrolling away, reading the book on my laptop over the past couple of days, and it's a very exciting publication, the first study of ancient theatre and performance in this area. I'll let Edith and Rosie tell you more about the background to this project and cover aspects of the book in greater detail. But to start things off, we're all taking a look at a vase fragment from Kyiv, which features quite prominently, both on the cover and the frontispiece of the book. So I'll hand over to you both, Edith and Rosie. What's the significance behind this fragment?
Well, this is one of the most striking pieces of evidence we've got for Greek theatre in the last third of the 5th century BC. It dates from between about 430 and about 420, so we're talking the absolute heyday of certainly Euripidean and Sophoclean tragic performances. And Rosie will be able to tell you far more about the extraordinary costumes and dance moves and masks, which are quite unique evidence. It would be extraordinary enough if it had been found in Apulia, right, or in Athens. But actually, it was found way, way, way up the estuary of the River Bug, which comes down through borderlands between Russia and the Ukraine to Olbia, which was Olbia Pontica, quite extraordinarily important northern Black Sea colony. And it's evidence that somebody up there not only really loved ancient Greek theatre, but had somehow or other got from Athens, it's made in Athens, a really very elaborate pot celebrating not just Dionysus, not just wine drinking, but the dance moves of the chorus. I think Rosie should actually describe what's actually on it.
Okay, so absolutely. This, when I was doing the book on costume, this was one of my go-tos. This is extraordinary in its detail, and thanks to Edith's work with David Braund, getting proper photos of these published in 2014, it's really changed the way that we can use this evidence. And it's extraordinary. So the detail on it is really exquisite, especially actually for the aulos player, you know, the musician there right in the center, and you can see his cheeks are puffing out as he's blowing into the pipes. And I think what comes across very strongly for me on this is just, you know, it's a few fragments pieced together. We don't know what the wider composition on this wine mixing bowl was, but what comes across is that interest in performance, the dynamics of it, the excitement of seeing a performance piece. And as Edith said, not just a dance for Dionysus, but, you know, this is theatre. And we know that thanks to the mask, thanks to the musicians. So you can see on the fragment, we have two chorus members masked, fully costumed, playing the parts of female dancers. and then in the centre, the Aulos player with the musical accompaniment, and a mystery figure, maybe a boy there, lower down in front of one of the performers and clapping. And I think one of the things, apart from, you know, the dynamics that you get from the musician being shown really, you know, in full flow, this is either a performance or a rehearsal. The other thing that strikes me is that gaze that you have between the boy, the extra, whatever you want to call that figure, and one of the performing chorus members. And that gaze allows us to see him as an internal spectator. So it allows someone looking at the vase to think through what it's like watching theatre. And that's a phenomenon we see in other vases too, especially actually the Pronomos vase, I think, is an interesting point of reference here. So it too is a monumental, spectacular crater showing cast after the performance of a tetralogy. And it too plays on that idea of what watching theatre is like. Now that's from a few decades later, but what's really interesting is that it too is found many miles from Athens. So you have this spread happening. But what, as Edith said, what makes this so unique and so important is actually it's decades before the Pronomos vase, and it's in totally the other direction. And so that Black Sea region, we have to ask what's going on.
We were incredibly lucky to get this photograph on the cover of the book, because we may talk about this later, but there's been historic real problems with getting materials out of museums in the former Soviet bloc. One of the reasons why people haven't researched the Black Sea anything like as much as they should have done in the West is because it was almost impossible before 1989. And indeed, even now, many of the publications are perfectly legitimately in the languages of the region, Russian and Ukrainian. And here I have to say, before we get any further, that Rosie and I, part of a team of three, of which, in my view, by far the most important member was Professor David Braund, who's not on this podcast. He's retired now and lives in Athens, but it was my talking to him, because this man knows Russian, he knows Ukrainian, he knows Georgian, and he has spent his entire career traveling around these countries, forging extraordinary relationships with museum directors and archaeologists on digs around the entire Black Sea area. He got these pictures of a great friend of his, who was called Professor Krapivina, lovely woman, who then died suddenly, only just after we got them, and we'd have lost our contact in the Kiev Museum. So the whole story of it was one of really thrilling discovery of a sort of new world and new frontiers for both modern scholarship and, of course, how far the Greeks took their theatre, which was literally everywhere they went. With Dionysus went theatre, and they always took Dionysus with them. Actually, in Olbia, when they first went and colonised Olbia, they couldn't get their vines to grow. First thing you always do is take your vines and start to make your wine. That's part of the whole colonisation ritual. They wouldn't grow. It took them over a century to do botanical things with them and grafting and goodness knows what else. So they had to import wines. But we know from their complaints about having to import this awful wine from Thassos, which they much resented, the amount they had to for their Dionysiac festivals. But the other really important aspect of this vase, which was what made my eyes light up when David sent me the photograph from Professor Krapivina, because David is nearly blind, I have to say. He's a phenomenal individual with very compromised eyesight. And he could not see, as I could, that the inscriptions over the two dancing boys are in the feminine gender. Beautiful, kalos, kalos. It's not. It's beautiful, Calais, Calais. Even though it is quite clear from the way the masks, which is one of the best pictures we've got of an ancient Greek mask, because we can see their short cut boy's hair, and their brown necks, but with these white painted faces and the attached hair to the wig. But this vase, uniquely, which is what we talk about in the JHS article, which is referenced in the volume, is that it paints the illusion of a female gender in performance. All other kalos, beautiful inscriptions on equivalent vases are in the masculine, recognizing the biological sex of the individual under the mask. This vase has really gone for it. These are beautiful women dancing, even though we can see that they're men. I saw this, I said to David, have you got any idea how important this is? And he said no. So we whisked off that article and sent it off to JHS, who lapped it up. And then because Professor Krapivina died, we dedicated it to her. And this whole book has got a lot of very, very personal stories in it, to do with sort of alienation between East and West, which is entirely kind of suitable to us trying to push the boundaries of the Greek world ever northeastwards rather than to Magna Graecia in Italy, which has been incredibly trendy, and Egypt with Oxyrhynchus. The Black Sea was regarded by a lot of the ancient Greeks as a joke place. It was like this backwater. You know, it's constant jokes for like, it rains, it's foggy, you can't grow wine there.
So you can't plant your vines, yeah.
Exactly. But in fact, once I started researching it, I discovered that it had, and I may yet write a whole book about Black Sea intellectual culture beyond the theatre, because I discovered so many important thinkers all the way through, even right to Christian fathers' disputes. You know, one of the greatest early Christians was Marcionus Sinope, which is practically in Georgia. So it was a huge adventure for us. And we met at the conference, which we may talk about later. We managed, despite visa problems, to get people from Georgia, Bulgaria, Romania, the Ukraine, and Russia. We actually didn't have anybody from Turkey. I ended up talking about the Turkish cities on the northern, the southern Black Sea coast. But it was very much a sort of post-1989 celebratory event that we could all sit together and talk about this stuff.
And I have to say, it was one of the most exciting conferences I've ever been at. And that's not just because I was part of the organisation of it. It was intellectually and personally so stimulating. And just to be in a room with people who had dedicated their lives to excavating and to discover these treasures, which were absolutely unknown in our scholarship. Rethink the whole thing.
Sorry, Rosie. The book is actually crammed with photographs that they have taken of the things that they had dug up. So it's not, this one image is spectacular. But for example, there's a wonderful chapter on sort of musical instruments of the Scythians and how they appear in theatrical contexts, which implies a sort of hybrid culture that's drawing on local performance traditions within the frame of Dionysiac Greek culture. And our wonderful contributor there has taken, you know, supplied all these wonderful, wonderful pictures. The book is genuinely worth it just for seeing these things. So each paper that came up, there were just gasps as the next picture of an extraordinary vase or a new mask has been discovered in the Taman Peninsula in a grave, or an aulos or a theatrical puppet turned up. And we were so happy because it was my first as a professor at King's College joint thing with the APGRD, with whom I've kept up such a relationship since 1996. And Rosie, who did her doctorate under the aegis of the APGRD, but when I was at Durham, she was our first PhD supervisee officially attached and paid for by one of the grants from
Do you remember when you interviewed me for that PhD and I said I was interested in costume? We were sitting at a cafe table with all this sunlight going on, and
you picked out
this picture of this Pronomos vase. And in my 4 years of studying, I'd never come across it, of course.
Yeah.
And you know, you said, what do you make of this? And that was, you know, before the Pronomos conference. But, you know, that was the beginning.
And of course, the Pronomos vase, we had a previous very successful conference at the archive, and Rosie and Oliver Taplin edited those proceedings. So this is a sort of joyful reunion for both of us to come back and actually talk on the vlog here. And when I suggested to Fiona that we do this as a joint thing with the Centre for Hellenic Studies at King's and the APGRD, I mean, she leapt at it. She thought this is exactly the sort of thing an archive should be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. You've both sort of alluded to this, but it might be nice to spool back onto slightly this richness that is evidently available in the Black Sea area. But it's very telling that this is the first publication bringing all this stuff together. And yeah, certainly looking at the region from a Greek or even a Roman prison, it is this backwater. It's a place people get banished to, Ovid famously. Do you think there are some more contemporary snobberies at play, maybe, or some sort of particular challenges that may have caused a lot of these works to remain hidden?
Yes, there are lingering prejudices against Eastern European scholars. I had to rebuke a member of the Western European delegates at the conference, who will remain nameless, for complaining that it was also positivist, right? That means we weren't doing any fancy theory. Nobody mentioned, you know, Deleuze. Sorry. The fact is that the empirical finds have not remotely been exhausted. They have not been catalogued, published and written about. And as Rosie said, these people are getting their hands dirty in the sands of Panticapion, which is modern, is Kirch now, every day. They really haven't got time to sit around worrying about whether it's just a sort of écriture construct or something. But I heard that and it really, really makes me very cross. But David and I talked about this a very great deal. And then when Rosie came in, knowing nothing much about the former Eastern Bloc, with her, not prejudices, but gaps in her knowledge, we needed her so badly for the fragments and for the visual evidence and the costumes. I mean, we needed her terribly, but it was very interesting. The point is that David is an alienated working class scholar from Bristol who was very interested in communism as a teenager and learnt all these, you know, in the 1980, during the Cold War, learnt all these languages. And he is a quite extraordinary scholar. I mean, he's published about as many books as I have, but he's never been recognised by the Western Academy. He's fellow of every single honorary institute you can name in the Eastern Bloc, but has always been dismissed as a sort of rather dubious person interested in the red countries, if you see what I mean. And if I hadn't become obsessed with one very particular thing very, very early on in my academic career, I wouldn't have written to David and said, I need your help. And it was that core relationship, which is actually back to 1985 or something, because I was so impressed that he knew all these languages and actually could get me free passes into museums in Soviet Kiev. And the thing that got us together was that the northernmost Stone Creek theatre that has ever been excavated is at what is now called Sevastopol on the west coast of the Crimea. When I discovered there was a theatre there, I could not believe it, because I had always wanted to write a book, which I eventually did, and it's another archive book about the history of the Iphigenia in Tauris. And Tauris is Taurike Kasonithos, which was the Greek settlement with that theatre. So I suddenly, and I do believe in the West, I'm the first person ever to have brought that theatre into conjunction with that tragedy, and got more and more excited and started exploring all of these ideas. And then the next person who got involved was Tony Harrison, the poet, who's a good friend of mine. And I wanted him to put on a play, something to do with the Iphigenia in Tauris, in that theatre, because he loves site-specific things. And I persuaded him to write this play. And we all went off. David and I, and Tony's wife, basically, I don't know if they're married or not, doesn't matter, Sian Thomas, that actress, and his daughter, confusingly called Jane Harrison, who is a Bronze Age archaeologist herself, though she does mainly Vikings and things. And we all went off a year before Putin annexed Crimea. We persuaded the museum officials to let us put the play on. But Tony wrote the play, and it ended up being produced on BBC Radio because Putin invented. And it was just an extraordinary saga of the sort of Black Sea archaeologist and the poet. We all going swimming together in the Sea of Azov. And Tony wrote poems about it as well. So it's enriched my life absolutely phenomenally. But I knew neither David nor I was qualified to talk about pots the way Rosie can. So, and anyway, I love Rosie. She was my PhD student. So I thought, what fun, let's all do it together. So it was a very, very happy story. But then Putin went and invaded a year after our reconnaissance trip. And thank heavens, you can't get in there now. It's unbelievably difficult because it's top security. I mean, the Russian Navy has put its nuclear subs back into Sevastopol Harbour. And I went round almost every museum in Crimea with David and Tony, and I took all the photographs. I mean, I just could not believe the uncatalogued Greek pots everywhere. Every single, even little museums like a place called Theodosia, the Russians call it, had about 400 vase fragments with masks or Dionysus or whatever. But I got the pictures out. So Putin do what he likes. We got them out. And then when Rosie saw them, she literally couldn't see believe her eyes, I don't think. Could you, Rosie, when you saw these pictures?
No, exactly. I mean, where's all this stuff been? It's been right there. But I think there is something also in that question about why people haven't gone there, and their sort of attitudes towards the region. And as you put it, Claire, the snobbery, it's to do with where people feel safe in terms of, you know, discipline wise. And I mean, the ethnocentrism, which dominated even when I was studying as an undergraduate, it was slowly changing, but that relatively recently. So, you know, that I think has a huge amount to do with it. Also, disciplines. and the idea of, you know, the text and studying the text versus actually, yeah, looking at archaeology and saying, yeah, of course we can look at a pot and also analyse poetry. It sounds like an absolute no-brainer. But again, I think there's a real lag in sort of catching up with that.
We were determined, that's why we invited, there's two highly literary papers in, one by Felix Budelmann, who's of course attached to the archive, on mind games in the Iphigenia and Tauris, and the other by Fremma Zeitlin on way that Black Sea stories of Black Sea heroines and Achilles and Helen haunts the imagination even of the second sophistic, right? And these are extremely literary. Mm-hmm. And putting these two people opposite at the table from some of the most grimy, you know, straight out of the excavation, hardcore, a very serious Russian archaeologist, and forcing them into debate. And I think when the reviews of this book start coming out, I mean, it only just came out the end of last year and then we had COVID, but I know from two people that they are reviewing it now. I don't think anybody's ever written a book like it that has sort of quite so much of a variety of approaches in it. And there we should mention Kate Bosser, but she was a huge friend of the archive. She's a brilliant young scholar who was doing all of this for Sicily and South Italy. And she had a job, she died tragically young in 2013. And she had been going to write the first chapter of this book for us because she has, in a wonderful edited a wonderful CUP volume about Greek theatre in the West, again, in the colonies, in the provinces, but of the West. And her own PhD thesis, I have just finished editing, it was posthumous. I had to get it ready for publication, and that will be coming out next January. So we took huge inspiration from what Kate had done with the West, but the evidence there is completely different. The evidence there is masses and masses of stone theatres. You know, you go around Sicily, there are stone theatres everywhere. There are hardly any stone theatres in the Black Sea because it was so well forested, they were all wooden. Simple as that. The one at Sevastopol, Torike Kosonisos, is actually very, very unusual. Our evidence is little tiny bits of things in museums and textual fragments. But the other thing, and this is where Rosie really needs to talk, is that there is not a single extant tragedy set in the West. We know there were a couple of plays set on Sicily, like Sophocles' Kokolos, but they haven't survived. We have 30 tragedies, and do you know what? Two of them are set in the Black Sea. The other one is all about the Black Sea. Rosie edited the actual chunk of the book, which is about the tragic texts.
Yeah, and it's extraordinary, isn't it, when you think about the Medea, one of the best known tragedies. And the Black Sea, as Edith brings out in the volume, she talks about the Black Sea as a backstory for the Medea and how Euripides plays on that. But it's extraordinary that, you know, that's probably the first point of contact. That's why I knew where Colchis was. From where is Medea from? They refer to it as, oh, where's that on a map, right? So that might be the only exposure people have to, you know, the idea of the Black Sea. It's right there in one of the most popular texts, but it often, I think, you know, you stop at the point of, oh, okay, there's where it is, and then you think about the Argonauts, and maybe that's the end of it. But once you start looking, not just at the, you know, the plays that are set there, and obviously the Prometheus Bound is very important, and the Iphigenia and Tauris, but then going further and looking at the fragments, we have at least 12 fragmentary plays, yeah, by Aeschylus, Sophocles and Euripides, which are probably set in the Black Sea, and that all three of them are interested in it points to its importance. So when you're thinking about the region, it's not just that it's a geographical region where the Athenians are in effect exporting plays, a geographical region where drama is spreading. It's also a space in the tragic imagination. And we can see just how embedded that is by looking at the links between those existing fully extant tragedies and the fragmentary ones. So you can do that in all sorts of ways. To give one example, Sophocles' Colchian Women, which is all about Jason's adventures and trials when he's in Colchis, refers very explicitly, you know, there's an allusion to the Prometheus Bound. So what we have is clear evidence of one playwright nodding to another playwright's use of that setting and saying, I see what you did there, and I'm going to run with it further. And when you start looking at Colchian Women, What becomes very, very clear in that play, as I argue in the volume, is its interest in using the Black Sea as a space for thinking through what Athens is doing with its colonial ventures. And what's really important here, in 437 BC, around then, Pericles had gone on his expedition to the Black Sea. So it becomes, in Athenian cultural imagination, this space becomes really prominent. I think it's already been there in tragedy. And you can trace it, of course, in other genres as well, in Herodotus, in Pindar, and in even further back to Homer. But actually, there's something particular going on with these dramas. And you can, as soon as you start looking in the thematics, you can see these motifs of wonder and danger and appropriation. All those help Athens to think through their identity. And it's right there in the plays, as we have them, the surviving ones, but also in the fragments as well. So in a way, we were looking and thinking about, well, this region has been neglected as a place where there's a wealth of archaeological evidence. It's also been neglected as a conceptual category for drama. Of course, people know the Black Sea as is an important think space, but I think its prominence and importance within drama and its recognised dramatic potential amongst the playwrights is really important.
Just to supplement that, with religious identity, all three of these stories of Medea, of Argive Iphigenia spending 20 years as high priestess, of Artemis in Crimea, and Prometheus are related very tightly to cults that the Athenians actually had on their territory or that they were extremely familiar with. So if you take the Prometheus in conjunction with the fragments of its trilogy, it's almost certain it was related to the Athenian Promethea festival, where there were torch races. That's almost certainly the case. Or the Hephaestia, or both. At the Hephaestia, we know there were even more dramatic performances. The Iphigenia in Tauris is the etiological charter for the extraordinarily important cult of Artemis at what's now called Vravrona, Brauron. And that's where all the little Athenian girls used to go out when they achieved their menarche, when they became fertile. And they went, and Iphigenia goes to be priestess there at the end of the play and brings the cult statue of Artemis all the way from the Black Sea. So the Athenians are defining one of their most important female cults with that version. The Spartans also claimed that Iphigenia had taken that statue to Sparta. Everybody says, no, it came here. And in Medea, although the only real Athenian reference is that she persuades Aegeus, father of Theseus, to give her asylum in Athens at the end of the play, and the Athenian audience will certainly have thought, oh yeah, no, that was great when she came along, wasn't it? But the cult of Hera Acrae, which is where she's going to leave the corpses of her children, which Rosie and I visited in and had another epic swim in, actually. So it's across the Corinthian Gulf from Corinth. They're flight paths. She says she's going to drop them up. But that cult was absolutely pan-Hellenic. It was one where people who, especially men with pregnant wives, people went to ask for the preservation of children. And weirdly, in the Greek dialectical imagination, the symbols of that cult become the destroyed children. I mean, that's such a classic piece of Greek unity of opposites sort of thinking, blind seers, that kind of thing, curses who were also revengers. So the Athenians knew about this, and we went there, and there was an enormous and very, very rich temple of Hera Acrae, which was just over the isthmus, so not a long journey for the Athenians. So once we started drawing all of these different links together, although it is a discovery about the hybrid Greco-barbarians of the Black Sea, because Greek men went into marriage out there. These are very hybrid communities. Thucydides and Herodotus has called them things like Mexobarbaroi and Hermibarbaroi, that kind of thing. But also, it's deeply crucial, for everybody who just wants to talk about the Athenocentrism of Greek tragedy, as Rosie said. So it's, I believe, not just for people interested in peripheral studies, which I admit I've always had been fascinated by peripheries, especially given the strength of the Greek barbarian dichotomy in the Athenian mind. Actually, it wasn't like that in their colonies in practice, one little tiny bit.
Really interesting. Thank you. Going back to the book, for sort of the structure of the book and its origins for a moment. So you mentioned this has been a long time coming in terms of your very epic sounding 2011 Crimean road trip and the conference proceedings. There's also quite a lot, as you said, within within the contributors. You've got the scholarly and the poetic sitting alongside each other. You have, as you say, you kind of the grittiness of archaeological finds alongside literary analysis. Can you see this paving the way for any future work on the area, or is there something ongoing that you're happy for us to talk about?
Well, as I said, I'm on that area. Kate Boss's forthcoming book is, to my mind, very much part. These books talk to each other. I had already read her manuscript, so there's quite a lot of places in our book where we talk about the actually links between pots with a particular play on turn up both in far east of the Black Sea and in the West. You know, there are colonial links. Things are actually bypassing Athens sometimes. I'm not at the moment going to pursue this. I believe that there's a doctorate could be written on the material in every chapter. What we've done is carve out the terrain that will allow people to develop it on. The book is one of those that asks as many questions as it answers. An awful lot of the chapters end on a question mark because some of them are very empirical, and I'm not ashamed of that. So, for example, Alexander Minchev, total hero. He's the retired supervisor of the most important museum of antiquities in Bulgaria. And he did an interpretative catalogue. I won't claim that he does much more than tell us what there is in to do with theatre in Bulgaria. I mean, he's a brilliant archaeologist and art historian, so he describes them very well. But the point is, someone needs to go and do something with that and actually talk about the identity of the particular city-states within that country. Do you see what I mean? And I would be very, very happy to supervise such doctrine. It did take an awful long time to come out. And the main reason, I mean, again, learning about other cultures. I have to say that Russian scholars have a very different attitude to time from Western ones. So actually getting a book out only 6 years after the conference, to them is quite an achievement, right? They would not be hurried. And just like life with three editors, David's wife was very ill, Rosie's father died, my mother died, Rosie had a baby, you know, Rosie was very ill after having a baby, life took its toll. And David also takes 2 days to read an article with his sight problems that some of us could get done in a couple of hours. So it's also very...
And he had to do all the translations.
Oh yeah, yeah, he did all the translations.
The bibliography alone, that's the crowning achievement here.
That's your achievement,
Rosie. It was there. I mean, it was so complicated. Yeah.
But it's all there. It's all there. If anybody wants to go, what I'd really love to get is actually, I've made great friends with the Georgians myself now. And I go every year, another link through this, to Tbilisi.
Because of the sparkling wine.
Yes, it is some of the best wine in the world. Actually,
the Dionysus was successfully transplanted over there.
Exactly. And I've been to several other universities, and I'm now actually helping by going and talking. And so is Fiona. We're both going to Tbilisi next year, Fiona McIntosh, to help. There again, for the archive, it's brilliant. We discovered the entire Georgian tradition of Medea plays, which Fiona's editing a new volume, which I write about in that. This has opened up new reception scholarly links, as well as classics in its own time scholarly links. As well, I would like to write a short book later, as I say, about Black Sea intellectual life. And one of the reasons for that is that I've done a lot on reception of classics in the British Raj. I mean, there are enormous parallels between the way that Britons talked about having to go to India, right? And they either fell madly in love with it and went native and got an Indian wife, like my husband's great-great-great-grandfather was one of those, or they absolutely hated it, couldn't wait to get back, their wives would die of a fever. But the way it was talked about in Britain was of utter boredom. It's like, we don't want people talking about the tigers that they've caught. But my goodness, those nabobs came back with wealth. My goodness, and the Black Sea was a gold mine of slaves, corn, and fish, and wood. It was crucial to the ancient economy. We need more investigation of that side of things as well. And I think I often think, Rosie said quite rightly, the Pericles' expeditions were crucial. A lot of those guys in that audience had been on a terrifying voyage through the mouth of the Black Sea, which is extraordinary. I've done it myself. I've been on a cruise ship. I lectured on a cruise ship. And it's really, really, really turbulent, even in a great big modern ship. If you had to row your way through not just the Hellespont, but and you actually get into the gates of the Black Sea. It's incredibly narrow. It must have been absolutely as terrifying as you can possibly imagine. Number of shipwrecks in that part of the Black Sea, the Western Black Sea, that have been discovered confirms what Xenophon said about it being the most dangerous. So people really were very, very, very frightened of Pericles saying, right, you are rowing on the next trireme to the Black Sea. And you get that in the songs of the Phrygian-Aryan towers. They talk about the terrible danger over and over again. So it's a perfect place to really think about what it's like to have colonies in a place you don't really like going to, but you need
it. Well, life and death.
Yeah.
It's all over these places.
It is, yeah. Rose's next interest is in funerary vases and rituals, but actually the Phrygian-Aryan Taurus ones will come in there, won't they, Rosie?
Yes, well, exactly. Because of that, what it is in the cultural imagination, you know, as a sort of place of the afterworld, there are so many ways in which it can help the Athenians to think through who they are. It's no surprise at all to me that it dominates in these tragedies once you start to look for it.
That's really interesting, thank you. I mean, now envisaging multiple doctoral applications starting to flood in off the back of this book, which is potentially very exciting. We need another conference, clearly. Yeah. So the natural progression from this. Thank you so much, Edith and Rosie. That sounds absolutely fascinating. We could have probably gone on for double the time. So do check out all of the contributors mentioned. Once we're back to normal, if anyone's visiting the APGRD, you'll be able to consult a copy of the book in our library, in our study room. And you're also very welcome to get in touch with us via the APGRD website. We'll have an accompanying blog post alongside this podcast so you can get a slightly clearer idea of what the book entails. And you can also get in touch with Edith and Rosie on Twitter at Edith May Hall and at Rosie Wilds. Thank you so much to both of you. We hope to have you back on again.